Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
And I'm pegging them up, and I'm laying them down, driving this rig from town to town, and you oversized though, you're never gonna slow me down, down, down. Slow me down, and you oversized load, you're never gonna slow me down, and you oversized load, you're never gonna slow me down.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? Born and raised in Northeast Arkansas, Brad Williams plays, sings, and writes country music songs. You may recognize Brad fronting the local honky-tonk outfit, the Salty Dogs. The Salty Dogs music is available on iTunes and at a music store near you. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark toured and played with blues legend John Weston and can be heard on John's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we do a featured artist for our set, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Christy Young, and our featured piece is this painting right here called Guitar Cowboy, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Christy at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, we have a very special show, something we've never done before, a tribute show where our writer, Randy Tardy's friends, are reading his stories for him. From Helena, Arkansas, Randy Tardy is the retired transportation business writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette in Little Rock. He covered railroads, airlines, and river traffic from 1976 until 2001. Randy, who is now in hospice, would like to share his stories with the world, so they will be read by his close friends. All stories are true and told by the friends of the Southerner who lived them. Later tonight, Rex Nelson reads Randy's story with several colorful Helena, Arkansas characters, and we'll end the night with Walter Walker reading Randy's story about a round-trip train ride when he was 9 years old. but let's start the night on a hot back road between Highway 1 and Randy Tardy's grandfather's cotton gin in North Creek, read by Harvey Joe Sander.
Oklahoma may have been the Dust Bowl, but back in the early 1940s, the road leading from State Highway 1 to my grandfather's cotton gin at North Creek had to be the dust road, particularly in the hot summer months. I was 9 years old when he died in 1941, so I was younger than that when he put me in his 1941 Chevrolet business coupe, and we'd go from our 10th Street home in West Helena to North Creek. At that time, it consisted of a gin, a country store, rough wooden sides and floors, as I recall, and a gravity flow SO gasoline pump. Nearby, a huge towering shade tree with ropes dangling from a limb supported an old tire. Kids loved to sit in the tire and go up and down and back and forth to try to stay cool. No one knew anything about air conditioning. The store's two attendants, as I recall, were Gene Clements, a farmer, and Doc Wallace, a retired pharmacist. In dry season, the Chevy had turned an interesting shade of dust tan by the time we got there. "What's going up?" Granddaddy would ask Gene C., and he would deliver a full report on the business, how the gin was doing, if it was ginning season at the time. And then Gene would look at me and say, "Youngster, you want to earn a free Coke and a candy bar?" I never passed up the chance to get free soft drinks and candy, so I said yes. "Go out there and pump up my gas tank," Gene said. There was no electricity to pump the gasoline from the tank underground into the delivery area atop the pump. You had to hand crank the fuel upward into the pump so it would flow down. For a preteen, that was work. It took a while. Sometimes I did not think I could get the delivery tank atop the pump filled, but I kept going until I had. "Mr. Clements, it's full," I proudly told him. "Go get you a Pepsi or RC or a knee-high," he said, "and pick out a candy bar." I'd reach into the non-refrigerated cooler. The tall glass bottles were virtually floating in huge lumps of ice. I would pull out my drink, wipe it off, get my candy bar, go out on the porch and watch the world go by. Except not much of the world went by, and when it did, there was so much dust you could not see it. In the fall and winter, when there was often a cold rain, the dust became a sea of mud. I would go with Granddaddy over to the gin and watch them suck cotton from the mule-drawn wagons, running it through the gin machinery with names like Murray and Loomis, compress it into bales, and the end product would come out the other end wrapped in brown bagging with black straps holding it tight. When there were enough bales, they would load them on a truck and haul them off to Helena Compress or Federal Compress. Trucks hauling cotton bales were familiar sights during ginning season. I knew a few kids my age out there, sons of sharecroppers who rented land from my granddad for a percentage of their crop profits. A few were African American, but most were white. We would head to the seed house where cotton seed had been separated from the lint during the ginning process. I don't know what effect the cotton seed lint had on my tender lungs and still don't at age 80. But we would enjoy jumping off wooden beams into the soft piles of white seed. What I do know is that by the time the kids got through playing in the seed house, we were all about the same color. Next door to the store was a pretty little pond dotted with a few trees. Sometimes on Sunday, when we would go out to the gin, there would be a baptism, folks being fully dunked into the water. Sometimes it was a black group, other times a white group, and a lot of family looking on. The store itself was a hodgepodge of things for rural needs. Tough nut, work clothes, red bandana, straw hats, bags of feed, patent medicine, Lydia Pinkham, Cardui, and a bunch of other long-forgotten brands. A few cans of vegetable soup, etc., nothing frozen. The store did not have electric lights and all kinds of tobacco products, especially chewing tobacco, Kingpin, and spark plug. And snuff, much of it under the Garrett brand. Roll-your-own cigarette papers were popular. The country was still coming out of a depression, and folks, especially sharecroppers, did not have a whole lot of money. A few years ago, my son Ed, my old friend Walter, and I revisited North Creek. The corrugated sheet metal from the gin was still standing, or rather hanging. Machinery long gone, seed house gone, beautiful old tree and swing gone, store gone. As Margaret Mitchell's book said, gone with the wind. Thank you.
Harvey Joe Sanner is a retired third-generation farmer from Des Arc, Arkansas. He is a former president of the American Agricultural Movement, and in 1979 drove a tractor in the Great Tractorcade on Washington, D.C. to protest farm policy. He's been advocating for family farmers and rural issues ever since. Next, it's the mid-1950s as Randy Tardy delivers the news on a now infamous radio station in KFFA Radio in King Biscuit, read by Rex Nelson.
I worked at radio station KFFA AM 1360 in Helena from 1956 until July of 1959. I set up locally prepared newscasts, and I delivered them using information gathered from local sources, our Associated Press newswire, handouts, and local interviews. As I recall, my live newscasts were weekdays, 8 a.m., noon, 5 p.m., and a 6:15 p.m. wrap-up of the day for 15 minutes. My noon program was unique, though. It immediately preceded the 12:15 broadcast of King Biscuit Time, which had been on the air since around 1941 and is still going to this day. Interestingly, the musicians stored their instruments in the corner of my newsroom. So did the janitor. He stored his mops, his brooms, and his bucket there. I even had a vertical rack of glowing and buzzing radio tubes in there, which kept the station signal going out. Transistors would not come along for a couple of more years. Well, one noon hour show, I was talking about an explosion of some kind along the Texas or the Louisiana Gulf Coast when the King Biscuit drummer came walking in the newsroom to get his instrument. He had trouble holding on to it, and as I was reading the story about that explosion, there was a wham in back of me, timed right with the word explosion as I read the story on the air. It was not a funny story, but the timing almost got to me. It was hard to get through the rest of that newscast. I looked at the drummer. My microphone was still on, and he said, "Excuse me, Mr. Randy, I didn't go to do that." I knew he didn't, but I remember that moment until this day. I believe that drum that he dropped with its red lettering is still around, and it's on display at the Delta Cultural Center in downtown Helena. Another thought. When I would come into the station from making my rounds of the police department and the fire station and the local courts, I would park out front on York Street, and I'd put a nickel in the parking meter. Often, Dudlow, that was the name of the King Biscuit piano player, would be standing there, and this one time he asked me if I could give him a dime so he could, quote, "get me some soda crackers and a little bologna." That day, I actually had a pocket full of quarters because the gas station I'd just stopped at was out of dollar bills. I had put 5 gallons of gas in my 1955 Pontiac, and I was expecting $4 in change for those 5 gallons. I got it, but I didn't get it in bills. I got it in quarters. That's because they were out of bills. "Here, Dudlow," I said, "here's a quarter. Go have yourself a big lunch." He thanked me over and over. In fact, he looked at that quarter and said, "This will really help me tickle them ivories." You know, those were interesting times, fun-filled in many ways, and little did I know that the broadcast of King Biscuit would live on for decades and become the centerpiece of an internationally known blues festival. Sunshine Sonny Payne was at KFFA back then. In fact, he still is a legend himself. When folks sometimes refer to me as a pioneer radio broadcaster, well, I never looked upon myself as a pioneer. But there were not too many of us around in radio back then. One of those who was is my old friend H.R. Herbie Bird, who toiled for years in the operations of several stations. I remember him best as the news voice of Little Rock Station KLRA, AM 1010, which has been off the air for a number of years. Life goes on, but I wish radio news today were the real news we toiled to deliver way back then. Thank you.
Rex Nelson of Little Rock is the president of Arkansas's Independent Colleges and Universities and a writer. His weekly column runs each Wednesday in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and he is the author of the Southern Fried blog. In our final story of the night, Randy Tardy is 9 years old when he is given a round-trip train ticket that changes everything in The Delta Eagle, read by Walter Walker.
The date is easy for me to remember. Mother's Day, Sunday, May 11, 1941. I wasn't quite 9 years old, and I was one more excited youngster. That was the day the Missouri Pacific Lines inaugurated a brand new streamlined train from Memphis to Tallulah, Louisiana, via Marianna, Helena, McGee, and Lake Village. They called it the Delta Eagle. After all, we were in the heart of the rich Delta farming area. Farmers made good money with cotton and other products for many years. The railroads hauled agricultural products as well as people. I guess it was a couple of weeks earlier when my grandfather, Edwin A. Boss Hicks, prominent Phillips County planter and ginner, came home one day and called my mother into the living room. "Here, Marion Louise," he said, giving her 3 round-trip tickets. "You and your mama, Nellie Hicks, my grandmother, and the boy get on that new train they've been talking about and enjoy its first trip to Memphis and back." At age 9, minus a couple of months, I felt like I was on my way to heaven with a round-trip ticket. The big blue and cream-colored streamliner with the silver eagle on the locomotive's nose was no stranger to the area. Missouri Pacific had been showing it off with private runs, charters, and civic and business groups, etc. But this was the first run for the general public. A Mother's Day gift from the railroad, a train official proudly said. The Eagle was not a long train, only 2 coaches plus the 1,000-horsepower diesel engine made by the Electromotive Division of General Motors Corporation. The front coach contained a U.S. Mail Railway post office section and 60 comfortable seats for African-American passengers. That was the era of segregation, but regardless of a person's color, everyone around then was excited about Helena being on the route of the nation's newest streamliner. The second coach with 48 seats contained a grill, complete with kitchen, 2 tables, and a counter with 3 stools. No matter where you sat on the train, someone would take your food or drink order and serve you at your seat. I was up early that Sunday, so were my mother and grandmother. The train was scheduled to leave Helena shortly before 10 a.m., put us into Memphis a little before noon. The crowd was at the classic old depot at the foot of Cherry Street, which now serves as the Delta Cultural Center, complete with a meeting room known as the Delta Eagle Room. Mother managed to find a parking place in front for our 1939 Pontiac. As we were not staying overnight, there was no luggage to fool with. Mother and grandmother sat on one of the depot benches and talked with friends they knew who were also making the trip. Little Randy went outside by the track to listen for the deep sound of the diesel's horn. I also looked at the little gas electric doodle bug parked near the depot. It had arrived from Clarendon shortly before 9. Finally, we heard the Eagle's horn blowing as it came in from Helena Crossing, past the Helena Cotton Oil Mill, and as it neared the Arkansas Street crossing by the Economy Grocery. Lights were flashing red on the street as the switchman fixed it where he could back in the 4 or 5 blocks into the station. Then slowly we headed in that direction as our eyes watched for the rear end of the new train to come into view. One final blow of the horn as the train crossed the road leading up to the seawall and down to the Helena Ferry Landing. Finally, with hissing and air horns and cheers from the crowd, the beautiful train hummed to a halt.
Doors were open and the few passengers getting off at Helena did so. Then it was our turn, stepping first on a step stool, then grabbing a handrail and making the next two or three steps into the coach. The train had a new smell to it, plus the waft of breakfast food cooked for others on the train headed north. We found seats together away from the May sunshine, and Grandmother wondered how long it would be at the station. About that time, I said, "Look, Mom, we're moving." The smooth diesel eased out of the station. We could hear the horn blowing as we began gathering speed, heading for Helena Crossing, where the Helena Bridge now comes into town. Continuing to pick up speed, we were soon crossing the highway where my grandfather's Y Camp Gin was located. And in a little while, we paused at a busy railroad point known as Lexa. This is where the railroad iced a lot of their refrigerator cars from the Rio Grande Valley as that produce headed north and to the east. My Uncle Julian Tardy ran that icing operation for City Products Company out of Chicago. Next came Mariana, then Hughes. More people were out to see the train than got on it. I did not know anything about head counts at that time, but I could see the Eagle was pretty full. During the war years, Pearl Harbor was only 7 months away. There would be many times when there was standing room only on the train, even with a third car added to the consist. I wanted something to eat, but Mother kept saying, "No, honey, we're going to eat when we get to Memphis." So I settled for a Coca-Cola at the price of 40 cents a bottle, plus a dime tip. Who ever heard of paying 50 cents for a Coke? The conductor stopped at our seat to visit and let me examine his ticket punch. He had been by shortly after we left town and punched our tickets, but he was too busy to stop then. Next thing we knew, the train was on a trestle as we neared the Mississippi River. As we crossed the Harahan Bridge, we could see the Memphis skyline and the muddy waters of Old Man River below us. Also, cars were on the single-lane road paralleling the train track as it crossed the ridge. Once across, we threaded our way through a maze of tracks used by the Rock Island, Illinois Central, Frisco, Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis railways, as well as the Missouri Pacific and Cotton Belt. The Rock Island had its own streamliner that served Arkansas, the Choctaw Rocket, which ran daily between Memphis and Amarillo, Texas, and served Forest City and Brinkley before entering Little Rock at the famed Choctaw Rock Station, which now houses the Clinton School of Public Service. After gliding past Roland, where I live now, it stopped at Boone before exiting the state. I wondered what it would have been like to have watched the rocket go by right down the hill from my current family home. A couple minutes before noon, the Delta Eagle backed into the Memphis Union Station. The conductor on the PA system thanked us for riding and invited us to come again. Mother, Grandmother, and I quickly found a yellow cab which took us to the Peabody Hotel for what we thought would be an elegant Sunday lunch. I don't know what kind of fancy food they had, but all Randy wanted was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. "Surely you want something else, honey. We're at the Peabody," my mother said. "No, I don't," I replied. So they dined royally. I enjoyed my two slices of white bread spread with peanut butter and jelly just like at home. After lunch, I looked through the lower level window into the studio of radio station WREC, which I could pick up at home clearly. Little did I know that I had jobs in radio coming my way, first at KFFA in Helena 15 years later, and then at KTHS in Little Rock, the 50,000-watt powerhouse known now under the letters KAAY. The ladies warned the window shop as stores were not open on Sunday. Mother noted some article of clothing she liked, wrote down the description, jotted down the phone number, a sign on the door. Around 3 p.m., we caught a cab from the Peabody back to the Union Station and made our way to the gate where the Delta Eagle was sitting. We boarded about 3:40 p.m. Many of the folks who had come up that morning decided to spend the night, so the train was less crowded on the return trip. Twilight eventually overtook us just as the glow of the street lights and car lights. Traffic was far from heavy in those days. Next thing I knew, I was sound asleep between my mother and grandmother. Been a big day in the life of a 9-year-old who hasn't lost his love for trains for more than 70 years. The swaying of the coach lulled me to sleep until I felt my mother nudge me and saying, "Honey, wake up, we're almost home." As I looked out, we were backing into the Helena Depot and I had arrived home with a lifetime of memories.
Walter B. Walker was born in Helena, Arkansas. He moved to Little Rock in 1962, where he worked as traffic manager for Dara Company, Mountaineer Corporation, and Orbit Valve Company. Walter retired in 1993. He is married to the former Jacqueline Stucker, also from Helena. So how about our stories and readers tonight? Thank you to our writer, Randy Tardy, and to our three readers. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
Drive me to drinking.